So having guided meditation here in this room a number of times, I've learned how to judge the effectiveness of a meditation. And either that you went really deep or you were really, really filled with sloth and torpor. Because there is hardly any chair creaking of the chairs. I led one meditation and I was just either it was just a restless in the room, but all the creaking of the chairs. I don't mean to take away from this class and this facility, but I just have to say the pews we have in Arlington on Monday nights are awesome. They totally slay these chairs. I don't know what it is about these chairs. I was raised a Quaker where we had these like wooden planks with pads filled with horsehair, and they felt like Lazy Boy recliners compared to what you're sitting on right now. You have to be very careful, too, I mean, to not make noise when you're meditating. Like, even if you wink, your chair is going to creak because you're throwing your angle off. Well, I'm really, really happy to be here with you tonight. I'm also aware that there are a number of folks from Monday night, and this is a talk I did give a couple weeks ago, but was feeling a little self-conscious about that, but then I realized, if you listen to it, a lot of Dharma talks, have you noticed how they're pretty much all the same talk? So you just let it wash over, see what gets absorbed. As I was reflecting on the topic for tonight, I was reminded of my father. And my dad had a really wonderful sense of humor, just a basically funny guy. He was diagnosed with early dementia, you know, with the promise of, you know, moving into Alzheimer's. And he sent me an email in the beginning, and he said, "Well, you know, well, the good news is now I can hide my own Easter eggs." And he said, "And I'm sure I'll be meeting new and interesting people every day." And he went into it with a tremendous sense of humor. And then his humor vanished as he became more under the influence of advanced dementia and Alzheimer's. And I read a lot on how to support someone in Alzheimer's. And there's a really beautiful book called The 36-Hour Day, which is published through Johns Hopkins. It's like in his 15th printing, I think, of just updating information of how to be with people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And I noticed there were just times when my father would just lose it. And then he would get very frustrated and then very angry. And that's referred to as catastrophizing. Because, you know, you're trying to keep a linear sense of your life making sense. And then when pieces drop out, it just doesn't make sense, and then you get scared, and then you catastrophize. And we all do that. Very easy to see with my father, so dramatic, but I realize as I really look at it, well, I do that too. I have a sense of where my life is going, and then somehow reality isn't cooperating with my plans, and then I catastrophize. So I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about something that is so endemic in our culture and a suggestion of some ways to work with it, and that is anxiety. And I'd like to kind of track this conversation as it goes through the four basic principles of the Four Noble Truths, that anxiety happens. If you get one of these portable flesh units, anxiety comes with the human experience. And if you look closely at your anxiety, you'll see that there are roots and there's a cause. And there's also a remedy. There are ways that you can actively turn toward and investigate that which is between you and feeling free or happy. And there's a path. That there are some beautiful strategies on how to move from that sort of chronic anxiety to a greater and greater sense of freedom and happiness. So I ran across this thing from the Smithsonian. Maybe you read about this, of how with all of the fossils they found of mammoths, of the great woolly mammoths, something like 60 or 70% of them are male. And they couldn't figure out what was going on. And then they realized, well, it's relatively simple in that the females in the herd, like the young females, were guided by a matriarch, a sort of a matriarchal clan. And so the males would be wandering on their own while the females were a little bit, you know, better taken care of. That really makes sense, but I think that the simple answer is they're dudes. If you get a bunch of male teenagers together, and having been one, the basic conversation is there anything dangerous and life-threatening we can do around here? And I had a strong streak of that myself for whitewater canoeing and technical rock climbing and free climbing and mountain biking and from a really early age. And I got really into motorcycling at a really young age, and I love it. It's really, really fun. It's like the closest thing to flying when you're riding a motorcycle. And there's real skill, there's art, there's counter steering, and so forth. And it's incredibly dangerous. So when you're on a motorcycle, there's a little part of your brain going, "This is fun, this is fun," and the other part of your brain is going, "Don't die, don't die." And it's kind of the alchemy of those two things that creates it really easy to be in the moment when you're in an experience like that, very absorbing. I did give up my motorcycle when I moved down to D.C. Distracted drivers, sitting in traffic with the fumes, it's really hot. And now, when I see people riding motorcycles, I wonder how I ever even did that. Particularly when I see guys wearing flip-flops and running shorts on a sport bike. It's just kind of horrific. But I chose motorcycling. But we don't necessarily choose our anxiety. It's baked into the culture, and it's baked into your nervous system. So I'm curious, did anyone feel any anxiety today? Where did you feel it? Yeah, there's hands on hearts, hands on belly. You know, we carry our anxiety on the inside. On the one hand, it's a very important function of your brain that keeps you alive. It identifies potential threats. It helps you come up with strategies to avoid those threats. And there's this little almond-sized part of the brain called the amygdala that's been called the seat of fear. And there's one in each hemisphere of the brain, regulating each hemisphere of the brain. And a recent neuroscience researcher said it's actually not so much the seat of fear as it is the seat of anticipation. So it's the mind that anticipates what's next. Constantly scanning for what might threaten you. So it's a helpful thing, but it's also a really debilitating thing when it's chronic. When that cycle of anxiety doesn't get a break, when you don't get a break, when you can't step away from it, it is deeply debilitating to your body. When you are in constant hypervigilance, constantly scanning for danger, your entire nervous system gets depleted. And of course, it affects your mind. And there's some very interesting recent studies that speak of how racial and religious intolerance comes from that chronic anxiety. As we become more fearful, we become more locked into the familiar and more frightened of the unfamiliar. And I think it's relatively easy to sense how much that's a part of our culture right now. Those who are just getting smaller around what they are familiar with and terrified by what they're not familiar with. So when anxiety runs you, it wears down your body, it affects your mind, it affects your emotions, and ultimately it leads to delusion. It leads to confusion where you start believing things are true when they're not, or you're believing things aren't true when they are. So it really is a question of how can you work with anxiety, knowing that it's a given in your life. And I think it's really important to note that anxiety is not a bad thing. There's a voice of wise discernment that's going on. That, you know, with that little voice that says, you know, you should really be more prepared for that meeting next week. There can be some real wisdom in that. Or do you really have enough money in your retirement account to retire? A little bit of wisdom in that too. So it's learning how to sort out the fear from that wise discernment on the inside. So that really leads to, well, what's the cause? When you really look toward, what's the root of anxiety when it arises? There's a very, very simple teaching story about this, which you may well have heard. It's the story of a teacher who is sort of receiving her students, and they were offering gifts. This one teacher gave the teachers a beautiful vase, just a beautiful handcrafted vase, and kind of set it next to the teacher. And then a wind came and blew the vase over, and it fell over and it broke. And the student was deeply upset about what happened. And the teacher said, it was already broken. So to cut to the chase of the root of your anxiety, you're going to die. Everyone you know is going to die. And on the way, they're going to get sick and they're going to get old. Everything you love about your life is going to vanish. That's the reality. As some great yogi said, you know, the greatest wonder in the world is that everyone dies. And the second greatest wonder in the world is that no one thinks they will. So when we believe that conditioned things are permanent, we are setting ourselves up for deep disappointment. All of your stress and anxiety arise when you forget that fact, that all conditioned things are subject to change. When you remember, or when I remember, something shifts. It's a very powerful shift when I realize, wait a minute, everything is changing. And this is part of the development of consciousness and part of the development of the brain. As we become more aware, we become more aware of reality. And really that is the essence of what calls you to practice, to see what's real. So you begin to see into the three characteristics of reality that anything born of causes and conditions is subject to change, that your relationship to what is changing is a direct correlation to the degree that you will feel stress and anxiety and suffering, and seeing into the nature of the self. But there's an aspect of you that is the product of conditions, your body, your belief systems, your thoughts. But there's also something about who you are that is unconditioned, that quality of pure, open, spacious awareness. And we get tastes of that, like in the, like that idea of the witness or being aware of flow is a little taste of that unconditioned, non-grasping quality of awareness. So much of this practice is about remembering. The breath-based meditation is referred to as anapanasati. The word sati means remembering. It's when we remember, then we rearrive. It's the coming home. So this development of the brain, the more we begin to see into the nature of reality, the more confidence we have in our perception, then there's a self-regulation quality that pops up. When you find yourself anxious about a meeting, something in the left part of the prefrontal cortex says, you know, you've done this before. You're going to be okay. Or when you find yourself nervous about a conversation you need to have, that little self-regulating quality of consciousness says, just remember your intention. You're really here to do no harm and to speak the truth. Oh, yeah, remembering. And of course, we forget all the time. And when we forget and we become identified with this self, this separate self, then we are subject to all kinds of forces. That's where the eight worldly winds come and just knock us around. The fear of failure, the fear of loss, the fear of shame, the fear of sickness. And with that, the opposite corollary of the desires that run us, the desire for success, the desire to win, the desire for fame, and the desire for wealth. I've met so many really successful people, like stunningly successful people, who are absolutely run by their fear and their anxiety of failure. Extremely successful and not happy at all. Jerry Seinfeld talks a lot about fear and anxiety, and he's got a whole bit where he talks about the fact that there was some study that said most people are afraid, more afraid of public speaking than they are of death. He said that means that the person giving the eulogy would actually rather be in the box. So we have our different strategies of how to work with anxiety. Some of us do whatever we can to avoid it. Some of us get a little counterphobic and take it on. And that was sort of my strategy, was that, well, if I'm afraid, I'm going to do it and show the world I can. There's a friend of mine came back from a men's group, some big men's conference, and he said, all comes down to this. Are you a one-day packer or a five-day packer? One-day packers, you just grab a couple things and go. You'll figure it out along the way. Five-day packers bring everything they could possibly need for any contingency whatsoever. He said, and it sounded amazing. They had this men's group. They had the one-day packers on one side and the five-day packers on the other. You know, and all the one-day packers were going like, you anxious wusses, you just got to be adventurous and go. And the five-day packers are like, you're the jerks who keep asking for stuff, you know, when you can't find your shampoo. So I was really, wherever I sensed I was afraid, I forced myself to do things. And it was a little crazy. And over my life, I took off for Europe for the whole summer with $200. Had a fantastic time. I met someone who had crossed the Sahara on his bicycle, and I thought, well, I should do that. So I tried. I was definitely a one-day packer, but now I'm a five-day packer. I want to just to reference something that I found so helpful in terms of working with my anxiety. When we talk about the acronym of RAIN, and you're probably very familiar with the acronym of RAIN, to recognize or realize what's presenting in any given moment, and then to inquire, can I allow or accept it? And then if you can, and sometimes you can't, and it's very strategic to let it know another time when the conditions are different, then you can be with it. But the I is to investigate. Actually lean in to really look closer at your experience. And then the N is to nourish what you find with compassion or kindness or some form of loving presence. A really beautiful formula. Just to credit Tim Ferriss, if you're not familiar with him, he gave a TED Talk on fear planning. And as sort of like a chronically anxious type, I got a lot from it, which is really about looking a little bit closer at your fears. And quite often in the practice, we sort of take a deep somatic dive into anxiety. And this approach is a little bit different, but I think you may find it helpful. And as we often say, this strategy is guaranteed, satisfaction guaranteed, or double your suffering back. So I was speaking with a woman who asked to talk with me because she had to go home to be with her mother, who recently had an illness and was going in for some tests. They weren't sure what the final diagnosis was going to be, but they were pretty sure it wasn't going to be good. She wasn't close to her mother. She had a brother who was completely absent. She had a sister who was in an open feud with her mother, just couldn't be in the same room. And she was not close to her mother at all. But she wanted to do the right thing. So she arranged to take a few weeks off to go back to the Midwest and be with her mother. And she was incredibly anxious. So we talked about this acronym of RAIN, and I asked her to describe, well, what did that anxiety feel like? And she couldn't even locate the bodily felt sense of it. For her, it was more like just this heightened state of hypervigilance. And you know that feeling when there's just like a heightened state of anxiety, or sometimes for me it's like a low-grade fever. There's just something in the background that's unsettled. When we began to kind of deepen the somatic investigation, then she was able to begin to describe it in a little more detail. You know, there was something aching, you know, in her chest. There was a deep clutch in her belly that she realized hadn't relaxed in a really, really long time. So when we had a sense of what that felt like, then I asked her, what are the top three things about this that make you anxious? What could go wrong? So we turned directly to investigate. So what could go wrong? What's the worst case scenario? And she said, well, I'm just terrified I'm going to get into my old patterns with her. She gets really judgmental toward me, and then I pull back, and then I get resentful, and then it all comes out really unskillfully, and it's just horrible. And then the second thing she said is, I'm really anxious that her diagnosis is going to be bad, and I'm going to be the only person willing to support her, and I'm going to move out there and lose my job, lose everything I've recreated here in D.C., and my whole life is going to come crumbling down. And the third thing she said is, I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm just going to fall apart. It's going to be too much. So those were her top three anxieties. And I pointed out how valid they are, that actually they might indeed happen. But if she was willing to look at them closer, we might be able to have a little more tea with them. So one thing, and you'll find if you check out this TED Talk, when we don't examine our fears and we don't examine our anxieties, they just continue to live and percolate on the inside. We have all of our strategies for not feeling, for avoiding, and so forth. But It takes so much courage to stop and sit down and have tea with whatever that demon, whatever that energy is. So there are two questions that can be very, very helpful when you identify an anxiety. The first one is, what could you do to prevent it from happening? And the second one is, what could you do to correct it if it did happen? And so we examine these, and just a little bit, when she talked about like the old patterns that might come back. And I asked, well, what could you do to prevent that from happening? And first it's like nothing. It happens every time. But then with inquiry, when you sit with a question, she sat for a while, and then a couple ideas started percolating. She said, well, I could do some extra sessions with my therapist to kind of prepare myself. She said, you know, I could actually maybe email my mom and see if we can create some ground rules for how we can be together. And even though her sister couldn't stand being with her mother, they had a good relationship. And she said, well, maybe I'll just bring my sister in the loop so I can talk to her about how to get through this. And we talked a little more, and she said, well, you know, what if I did a metta meditation for her? I just started really offering her loving kindness. So if she began to feel a shift in terms of what she could do to prevent that worst case scenario. The next one was, well, if it did happen, if everything melted down and fell apart, what could you do to correct that? First thing she said was, put my therapist on speed dial. Put my sister on speed dial. And then she said, you know, if I gave myself permission to step away, just to go to the pool and go swimming, that would really help me. And I could already see that restless hypervigilant anxiety was beginning to soften a little bit. So we talked about the next one, like if the diagnosis was bad and her anxiety was she'd have to give up the life she'd created here in D.C. and have to go back, give up everything to be with her mother. So to prevent it, she thought, well, she can't do anything to prevent the diagnosis. But she realized that she could check out long-term care policy. She could investigate local support for her mother. And while her siblings, they were good people, she realized that she probably maybe needed to have a conference call with her siblings in order to talk about how they were going to handle it together. And then if it did happen, she realized that it could be a really difficult conversation with her siblings, and maybe she needed a facilitator. Back to the speed dial with her therapist. And she realized that she was not willing to give up her life in D.C. And that was a big shift when she realized that I'm not going to do that. I'm saying no to that, but I'm saying yes to the life I want to create. And suddenly that anxiety sort of shifted into a sense of presence and a sense of confidence. So we talked again about the third anxiety, that she wasn't going to be able to do it. She realized, well, there are a number of things she could do to get grounded, to focus on her health, her vitality, her emotional well-being, have her support systems in place, to really get her allies kind of pulled together. What I love about this process is this is not magical thinking. This is a reality-based practice. So when you find yourself with that sense of low-grade anxiety, and quite often it's below the line of what you're aware of, but when you practice, when you really slow down and you practice meditation, you know, as we like to say, you know, you feel better. You feel your anxiety better. You feel your depression better. But when you really feel that anxiety, you can turn toward it and really sense, so what is this anxiety all about? What am I really afraid of? And then really turn toward it. You're looking for what's real, what really could happen. and whatever strategies you can employ to be with it in a conscious way. So perhaps just a little reflection, if you like, just to do a little inventory here. If you like, you can close your eyes. You might bring your attention to your breath. And you might just take a few moments to reflect on what's changing in your life. When you go through the files of what in your life makes you anxious, you might just take a moment to select just one particular anxiety that's strong in your life right now. And I'll offer these questions and give you just a little bit of time to let any images or thoughts pop up. When you reflect on this one particular anxiety, what's the worst that could happen? Can you think of two or three possible outcomes? When you have a sense of these possible outcomes, just taking the next little while to reflect on the following question: is there anything you can do to prevent that? And the second question: is there anything you could do to correct the situation if that did happen? And you might, when you're ready, deepen the breath a little bit. If you like, you can open your eyes or remain with them closed. When we are paralyzed by anxiety, oftentimes it's because we haven't really stopped to investigate it. And it takes real courage to really slow down and pause and really choose to see clearly into the nature of what's between you and feeling free. When we do, it can be quite powerful. There's a great question that Tim Ferriss offered when you're sort of caught in a problematic thing, to ask yourself, is there anyone in the history of humanity not as smart as you who figured it out? I found some peace in that. So the courage it takes to really name and investigate what makes you anxious makes all the difference. There's a New York Times article, a story of a man named Sean Tucker who had a 40-year career as an acrobatic flight pilot at doing stunts at air shows. And he said, I never told anyone how scared I was when I started flying. But what I learned was that fear turns into a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you have the courage to admit it, you'll be able to focus and prepare and rise above it. And this approach to actually naming fear or anxiety is getting a lot of clinical validation. Acceptance and commitment therapy is all about encouraging people not only to accept the fear and anxiety, but really examine kind of the values and their commitment to working with it. And again, it's about the intention to embrace the two wings of the practice. The first is the wing of wisdom, to see clearly, to see through your embellishments, your preferences, what is real. So when you feel anxiety, when you feel fear, the courage to name it. And then the second wing is how you be with it. To call on whatever strategies allow you to hold it in a way that it can shift and move and change. Another quote here, that psychologists and neuroscientists are finding out that the amygdala is less apt to freak out if you are reminded that you are loved or could be loved. For example, seeing images of people with frightened expressions is usually a huge trigger for the amygdala, but that response is greatly diminished when subjects are first shown pictures of people being cared for or hugged. What a state changer. And you may recall in sort of like the Buddhist mythology that when the monks would come for the rainy season and they would get instruction, then they were all supposed to go out into the woods, into the forest and meditate, you know, find a tree and sit down and practice. And in the early days, the monks went out to do that and they were just freaking out. Just the horrible, spooky sounds, a very deep cultural belief in ghosts, and they were really frightened by it. And they came back and they asked for more instruction. Like, it's way too scary out there. Is there any practice that you can give us that is going to allow us to tolerate the fear and anxiety of being alone out in the wilderness? And supposedly that's when the Buddha gave them the metta practice to wish yourself well, to wish yourself ease, to wish all beings around you ease and safety. And so that little statement of how the amygdala is calmed when you turn your attention to loving or being loved is a very powerful, how that ties back into developing your capacity for self-regulation and calling on that capacity of loving kindness. When you do it, it's not just an intellectual practice. You are dramatically shifting your entire nervous system. It changes your relationship to your perception of reality. So a good friend of mine has built up a really big and a really complex business. And he's, for the last couple of weeks, been in the process of selling it. And there are some really big companies that are, they're interested. You know, they're kicking the tires, they're asking really hard questions, and they're playing hardball. And my friend is the opposite of a pushover. He's a pretty tough guy, but he has been really anxious around this for the last couple of weeks. And if it happens, it's a gigantic win for him. It's not only will he be able to pay back his investors, but he'll have enough money to do what he really loves and take care of his family. And if it doesn't happen, his whole life is going to fall apart. He won't be able to pay back his investors. His reputation will be either wrecked or require a really long time for him to get it back. So as you can imagine, he's really sitting with a lot. And we talked a little while ago, and he told me how he woke up in the middle of a panic attack in the middle of the night, just, you know, heart palpitating and sweating and catastrophizing, utterly catastrophizing. And then he said, so I woke up, all this was happening, I thought, let me try some of this inquiry crap Jonathan's always talking about. So he thought, okay, so well, what's between me and feeling free right now? And it was like, oh, here it is. And then he said, well, can I allow it? And yes, he could. And then the investigation, sort of the somatic investigation, can I locate it? And he said, for a long time he couldn't. And then suddenly there was something in his heart just pounding. Really, really, this thumping, intense, hot pressure in his chest, and then down, really deep down in the core of his gut. Oftentimes, when we practice investigation of anything that's between you and feeling free, and you're investigating it through the felt sense, you know, again, we explore the wing of seeing it, you know, and he saw it. Here was this tight, thumping, intense feeling. And then we draw on the wing of compassion. And a very powerful question you can ask is, how does this want me to be with it right now? And that was the question that he asked. Okay, how do you want me to be with you right now? And he said he just kept asking it. And he said it was so surprising. He said it didn't need love. It didn't need to be coddled. What it needed was attention. It just needed attention. And so as we do in this practice, he just sort of fed it attention until it felt satiated. And then it melted. And he said it was like this, when he could locate the anxiety, he said the feeling of it wasn't that big. He said he almost had this image of it like a little tiny fan that was blowing dust that was affecting everything. But when he could really find it, to let it know he saw it, to ask how it wanted to be with him, it shifted, it melted, and he said, I slept really well. He said, I slept like a baby. I said, really? You woke up every 3 hours crying? He said, no, I just slept really, really well. So one way you can explore your anxiety is through that level of the mind, you know, to really inquire, so, okay, what's the worst that could happen? What could I do to prevent it? What could I do to correct it? And the other approach is to meet it energetically, just to sense what it feels like on the inside. And depending on which approach, they can both be very, very skillful. So perhaps another short inquiry before we close. If you like, you can close your eyes again. And you might take a moment to reflect on just something that's in your life right now that might spark a little bit of anxiety. It may be what you named before. It might be something different. And you might take a moment to let it know you see it. Here it is. And you might inquire, can I be with it for a little while? If there's a sense of yes, you might explore the following questions. When you think about this anxiety-producing event, what does it feel like on the inside? Can you locate it? It might be strong and unmistakable. It might be fleeting. It might feel a little vague and unformed. Take a few moments and sense if you can locate it on the inside. And you might inquire, is there a sense of how this feeling, this felt sense, is there a sense of how it wants you to be with it right now? Is there a sense of what it needs to feel more whole? And if it were to receive this, what would that feel like? Can you hold this in some kind of loving presence, some empathy or kindness or compassion? And you might just notice how this may have shifted in some small way. And perhaps to let this know your intention to be with it, if it needs more time and attention sometime down the road. And then if you like, you can deepen the breath and you can let your eyes open. For the first major part of my life, I was chronically anxious. And I'm really kind of surprised and pleased to say that I'm dramatically less anxious now. And I think in part, it just may be age, but it may have something to do with the practice. I remember when I did my first month-long silent retreat, there was a lot of dramatic insights, really powerful. And the next year, maybe 2 years later, I went back for another month-long retreat and really kind of expecting, you know, a lot of juicy insights. And it was kind of meh. And I was a little disappointed, you know. I practiced pretty faithfully, but you know, I had some insights, but there's nothing really super dramatic. And I kind of got back into my life and the busyness of my life. And then about 3 or 4 months later, Tara pointed something out to me. She said, "You are less anxious." And then I looked back and I thought, that's absolutely so. I always love this quote from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He created transcendental meditation and spoken these little aphorisms, and it's so corny, but it's so true. He said, "You water the root and enjoy the fruit." But that's so much of what this practice does. Every time you bring your attention back to the here and now, you are cultivating non-judging awareness, my preferred definition of mindfulness. The more you steep yourself in non-judging awareness, the more it's like you reset your whole nervous system. The more clearly you can begin to see into the nature of reality, the more clearly you can identify what's between you and feeling free. The more gap opens up between stimulus and response, and then the more creativity you have that really begins to shape and inform your life and everything you do. So I think it can be really helpful to reflect back on how the practice may have changed your relationship to anxiety. I was teaching last weekend with a good friend of mine. We both lived in the ashram for decades, and we both start off with like very, very little money, and we're very dedicated to our practice. And we've always joked about, you know, our fear was we were going to be making sandals out of truck tires and selling them on the corner. But we were talking at the end of the retreat, and we were talking about how much, both surprised at how much contentment we were feeling in our lives. And my friend said, "You know, I just feel," and I said, "I'm just so surprised at how I really feel the fruit of the practice. You know, I really feel really good and really happy." And I said, "Yeah, then you're going to die." And he said, "Yeah." And we both smiled. Let's close with a short reflection on death, anxiety, and liberation, all in 1 minute. So if you like, you can close your eyes. You might take a few moments again to draw your attention to the aliveness of here and now, the movement of the breath, the vibrations of sound, and the felt sense of here and now in your body. And it can be helpful to reflect on these four foundations of the practice. That your experience with anxiety and stress and suffering are all part of this human journey. that anxiety and stress and suffering have a cause that has to do with forgetting that all conditioned things are destined to fall away. And remembering that it is possible to remember. It's possible to increase your capacity for joy and happiness in this remembering. And to recall that there are practices, observations that continue to support you in your capacity to increase your capacity for joy and kindness and compassion and freedom. And in these final moments, if there is someone you know who is feeling particularly anxious or fearful right now, you might take a moment to wish them well, to wish them ease and peace and safety. Letting that well-wishing radiate out in all directions to all beings, including yourself. This breath, each cell of the body. And when you're ready, you can deepen your breath. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Thank you so much for your kind listening and your presence tonight. May you, your fear and anxiety, have a wonderful evening together.